When Donald Trump came down the escalator in Trump Tower on June 16th of 2015, I watched it live on TV and I was alarmed because I expected two things would immediately happen, and they both did. One was that Donald was seriously running a campaign for president, and that the politics reporters, the reporters whose job is to cover the horse race, who get rewarded for the horse race, not for policy, not for anything else, but the horse race, we're going to dismiss him as a candidate because in 2012 he had said he was running. Donald said, in effect, you know, I really should be president, but my TV show needs me. And there were only two journalists in America who had said all the way along, he's not running for president in 2012, he's running for a new contract with NBC, and that was Lawrence O'Donnell and me. And so I knew that the politics reporters wouldn't treat this as serious, and I set out to try to get them to cover him because I was concerned that people would not understand who he is. Now, yesterday I spoke to almost 700 students in Wexler Hall at the university, and I start off by asking them a few questions and asking them to raise their hands, and I want to do the same with you. How many of you know that Donald Trump, through most of the 80s, was very deeply involved personally and in business with a twice convicted felon, a major international drug trafficker named Joe Wechselbaum? Fairly good number of people. If we were doing a nationwide sample, it would be a lot smaller. It would be under, I suspect, 10%, because it was never reported anywhere except by me or a few relatively minor sites citing my work, even though it's all public record. Now, once Donald Trump was elected, and even he did not expect to win, in fact, his campaign staff, on the day the voting was taking place, November 8th, went around to journalists and were saying, like, hey, listen, you know, I'm sorry I treated you so badly. It was what Donald insisted we do, and I hope we'll have good relations in future races, because these are political people who expect to have future employment, and they don't want to have a lot of bad relationships. Well, as soon as that became clear that Donald had won the Electoral College, that changed. And Donald Trump began to build what the ancient Greeks called a kakistocracy, a government by the worst people. He appoints as Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. Wilbur Ross is a vulture capitalist. He's a guy who picks over the carry-on of dying companies, figures out how to strip some of the meat off and put it in his pockets, infuse this company with new debt after it's not paid off the debts it had, and send it on its way. Get an idea of how unqualified Wilbur Ross is to represent American commercial interests around the world. He went with Trump on Trump's first international trip to Saudi Arabia. Now, you may recall that during this trip, Donald Trump in Riyadh praises the Saudi government for joining in the fight against terrorism. You know who the biggest funders of terrorism in the world are? He attacks Qatar, where America has its biggest and most important military base in the Middle East, and where the last time they executed somebody was in 2009, as opposed to Saudi Arabia, where they make public sport of taking people's heads off. And in 2015 and 16, they did so at the rate of about 3 a week in public executions. They've been called by a British journalist the only, other than soccer, the only form of public entertainment allowed by the Saudi regime. So Wilbur Ross flies back to the U.S. and is immediately put on CNBC. And that's because, you'll recall, the Trump people said, we've signed $350 billion of business deals with the Saudis, basically arms sales. Well, in fact, they didn't sign a single deal of any kind. And almost all of the money in question had been already signed up by Barack Obama. They signed some letters to look at and consider some future deals that were much smaller. But of course, on CNBC, people who follow the stock market, they want to know, what does this mean for my investment? Should I be buying Lockheed and selling General Electric? What should I be doing? And when Becky Quick, the host, has finished asking her questions, Wilbur Ross says, I should tell you one more thing. Becky goes, what's that? Ross says, well, you know, they really love us in Saudi Arabia. You know, there wasn't a single protester anywhere. And Becky Quick immediately says, well, you understand, Mr. Secretary, that people are not allowed to protest in Saudi Arabia. They put you in jail if you do that. In fact, they put you in jail and they lash you with a bullwhip if you do that. But she just said they put you in jail. And Wilbur Ross comes back and says, well, theoretically that may be true, but let me tell you how much they love us. When I was leaving, they loaded onto my plane, the security guards who were assigned to me by the Saudi government, two baskets of dates. Now, what a heartfelt gift from my guards. These people have no business representing our country in the complex world that's out there. They have no idea what they are doing. And they're damaging our interests all the time. You know who's been the biggest friend of the ambitions of the government in Beijing? Donald Trump. Donald Trump came in and immediately said there will be no Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, I was one of the first and most vocal critics of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I was critical of it because it extended corporate power, which we don't need any more extensions of corporate power. It took away individual rights. It raised some questions about sovereignty that I raised. It's not clear how important those were. And it extended patents and other intellectual property rights for corporations. But I also recognize that the Trans-Pacific Partnership of 12 countries in the Pacific was designed to blunt the growth and ambitions of Beijing. It had a strategic purpose beyond the document itself. Donald Trump comes in, just kills it like this. Well, Beijing has its own plan, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Plan. It's 16 countries. It excludes the United States. It includes, however, India. And the Chinese are out there with their diplomats basically saying the following to all the countries in the Pacific. We're the nation of the future. Look at how badly the Americans in decline. Look at the guy that's president of their country. Do you really want to tie your wagon to that country? Pivot away from Washington and go with us. And that's exactly what's happening in the economies of the Pacific. Because Donald Trump doesn't know anything. And he certainly doesn't know anything about economics. Now, remember Trump's big chant, build the wall, build the wall. Who's going to pay? So what's his plan to make Mexico pay for the wall? Well, he announced not long after he took office, we're going to put a 20% tariff on Mexican goods, which means Americans who buy Mexican goods pay for the wall. This is, by the way, a man who has a degree in economics from an Ivy League school, Penn. Or as I always try to say, a man who was given a degree in economics by an Ivy League school. Donald appoints as his education secretary Betsy DeVos. Well, you know, the Detroit Free Press, where I worked back in 73 to 76, they did a huge project about charter schools. The editorial page editor of the Free Press believes in competition. He thinks that monopoly public schools are not a good idea. So he's basically a fan of this. But when they analyzed the data, they found that 38% of charter schools in Detroit were in the bottom quarter of all schools statewide in Michigan in their performance. But only 23% of public schools were. The charter schools were seriously underperforming the public schools. And trust me, Detroit public schools are not very good. Betsy DeVos is an advocate of religious education. That's what she really wants. She wants everybody to go to a Christian school of some kind and to learn her sets of values. And she's the education secretary. Who do we put in charge of housing and urban development? A guy who literally said and has never taken back that those pyramids in Egypt, those aren't tombs for the pharaohs, they're granaries. It is almost beyond belief that these people were approved by the Senate. So why is this happening? Why do we have Scott Pruitt, who has bodyguards around him all the time, where there's been an enormous drop in enforcement actions against polluters, where all sorts of material has disappeared from the files? Why do we have an attorney general who is, I'm not going to beat around the bush, Jeff Sessions is a racist. He's been a racist his whole life, and he intends to see to it that everything he can possibly do to make sure black people know their place and get locked up if they don't and don't get to vote happens. That's his view of the world, no matter how much he tries to dress it up. How do we get these people? Steve Bannon told us last week. Steve Bannon said they're going to run. And by they, I mean the far-right autocrats who think that billionaires should run the country like the Mercers. They're going to run primary candidates against every single sitting Republican senator who's up for election. And they're going to do it again in 2 years. They're going to do it in 2 years after that. Now, Donald doesn't have a grand vision like Steve Bannon does of what kind of a country we should be, okay? Donald has only one philosophy. You know, there's a wonderful saying that uncontrolled growth is the philosophy of the cancer cell. And Donald Trump's only philosophy is the adoration of the genetically superior, smartest person, world's greatest expert on more than 20 subjects, Donald Trump. To be blunt about it, Donald's delusional. He is not mentally balanced. And I've known this about him from not long after I met him. It took me a while to figure it out, but he's, you know, to use the vernacular, he's crazy. Donald creates his own reality. If he says it, it's true. So look what happened. If you listen very carefully or read the transcript of the remarks today by General Kelly about the phone call to the widow of one of the sergeants killed in Niger. And notice the White House doesn't want to talk about, what were these four guys doing in Niger? What were we up to? What national security interest was there? They don't want to answer any questions. Well, the Army will investigate the deaths. I don't care about the deaths half as much as I want to know about what were they doing there and what else are we doing? But Kelly comes out and explains that Trump was not trying to insult when he said to the widow, well, your husband knew what he signed up for. Now, I'm sorry, if this was anybody any of us know who got a call like that from the president, I think we'd reasonably feel like that's pretty callous. Kelly explains, however, how this happened, that basically Donald Trump bungled it. He tells that he and Donald have a discussion about should you call, and his recommendation is you shouldn't call because you can't do anything to make things any better. And then, in a very revealing comment, he says, Donald asked me what to say. How many people in this room have had to tell somebody else that somebody died? Okay? You're probably all going to have to do it before you get out of this life. Okay? And there are very simple principles to how you do that. If you're telling somebody that didn't know there was a death, you let them come to that realization. You don't just say, your husband's dead. You say, well, you know, there was an accident, and we took your husband to the hospital, and the doctors did all this work and an effort, and people feel much better when they come to that realization. And if they already know it, and you're calling to sympathize, it's all about them. You know? I'm calling you to tell you that, you know, your husband didn't die in vain. He died in the service of his country with his fellow sergeants, etc. And this is a horrible tragedy, but you know, we respect him. What did Donald say? He signed up for it. He knew what it meant. Now, Kelly, it turns out, was the source of those words. Kelly advised Trump about that. How was it that Trump got this wrong? Well, first of all, he had to be told, what do you say? And secondly, he doesn't listen. You know, if you listen carefully, one of the things Donald says is, I'm like a smart person. I'm not sure what exactly that means. I'm like a smart person. It's just like he's always saying, you'll find out. So are we going to attack North Korea? You'll find out. It's a way to evade the question. It's a way to put people on edge. It's a way to pull power to himself by creating uncertainty. And Donald has no empathy for other people. None at all. And Donald Trump right now is trying every way he can to figure out how to use nuclear weapons. And why do I say that with absolute confidence? Because during the campaign, Donald Trump said, among other things, I'm really good at war. Draft dodger Donald Trump, I'm really good at war. I know more about ISIS than the generals. I can learn everything you need to know about nuclear missiles in 90 minutes. And he also said, of course we're going to use nuclear weapons. He even said to Chris Matthews on Hardball that he would consider using them in Europe. I mean, it was like, what? Because he doesn't know anything. Well, he's about to go on a trip to Asia. And you look at all the aggressive moves we've been making against North Korea. Now, North Korea is a prison cult country. It is so poor that if you look at a nighttime satellite image of the world, there's a dark spot. It's North Korea. They can't afford electricity at night. The average income of North Koreans per year is the average income of Monroe County, New York residents where I live, where Rochester, New York is, every 12 days. Their annual income every 12 days. And by the way, people who've escaped have all told stories of how they were told that they were living in paradise and the rest of the world is a horror. And I watched an interview a few years ago with one young man who he couldn't believe there was ice cream. It's the most astonishing thing, the lights in Seoul. Donald Trump is trying to figure out how to use nuclear weapons. He believes that will make him more powerful. And he will try to create an incident. Now, hopefully, General Mattis has issued some kind of directive that if you hear that Donald Trump is trying to use the nuclear codes, you call me first. That's what Schlesinger did during the last days of Nixon's administration. But on this trip he's taking, if you look at where he's going and who he's talking to, he is trying to put things in place to do this. So let's just assume that he succeeds in doing that. That he, in fact, as he talked about the other day, just obliterates North Korea off the face of the earth. 25 million people. What do you think happens to our country? Remember when South Africa was a pariah nation? They'll be reduced to being an asterisk. Nobody's going to do business with us. Nobody. The Canadians are going to turn their backs on us. The Europeans, Beijing and Moscow's power is going to grow enormously. We will be cut off from the rest of the world and treated in the most awful and horrible manner. And even if the result of that is Donald Trump is impeached, convicted, and then criminally tried and convicted and sent to prison, it won't change that because it happened and we didn't stop it. Now, a few weeks ago, Senator John Danforth, former Senator John Danforth of Missouri, the man to whom we owe Clarence Thomas, who would have made a fine municipal court judge somewhere. John Danforth said, basically, we have an unbalanced president, a man who is not fit to hold the office, and we need to recognize that. And Scott Simon, I think it was Scott Simon, but whoever it was on NPR who was interviewing said, well, why are you saying this? Why aren't sitting Republican senators saying this? And the reason is that Steve Bannon plan. You speak against Donald Trump, and we got a bunch of right-wing millionaires and billionaires who will put up money and we will destroy you. That's what they did to Senator Johnston, no relation, from Utah, a principled Republican who was replaced by Mike Lee, a man who is a horror show of political beliefs. These are the people who have given us Mike Pence as vice president. You know, a man who's been credibly reported have said we should hang gay people, and who certainly believes the government should be in control of every woman's body. It's not hers, it's not even her husband's, it's the government's. And you know, who should go back, in my opinion, to his career as a small-town radio talk show host. there is a clear drive by an element of Americans to get rid of our democracy. Foreign Policy magazine has a piece out today about a worldwide Pew Research study on how people view government. Well, 86% of Americans either somewhat or completely support democratic government. Only 7% reject it. But then they ask the question, should a strong president be able to do whatever he wants without any review by the legislature or the courts? 1 out of 3 Republicans agree. By the way, so did 1 out of 6 Democrats. This is, I believe, part of a much bigger trend, and Donald is part of this much bigger trend. All around the world, we are seeing the rise of strongman, anti-democratic, fundamentalist politicians whose basic message is to go back in time. Donald wants to go back to this mythical 1950s with white picket fences. Modi in India wants to have a Hindu country. He doesn't want to have hundreds of religions in India. He wants his religion and his vision of that religion. We've seen the rise of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and other fundamentalist Islamic movements. We see in America the rise of these fundamentalist Christian movements. This is going on in other societies and cultures. And so we need to ask ourselves, well, what's going on? Why is this happening in all these different countries? Why aren't we moving more and more towards more freedom, more liberty, more ennoblement of the human spirit to see how it can flourish? And I think the reason is that the rate of advancement of knowledge and change is beyond the ability of many people to cope with it. I was driving around San Francisco today because I had 2 hours between meetings. And I was thinking of the San Francisco I knew as a boy in the 1950s. The San Francisco I knew in the 1970s when I was the LA Times national correspondent based in San Francisco. And even the San Francisco that I knew 10 or 15 years ago. It's not the same place. Bruce Brugman of the Bay Guardian's fear of Manhattanization has come home. It's been Manhattanized. I went back to my hometown where I grew up, Santa Cruz, and it's still kind of a quirky, weird place, but it's not the Santa Cruz I grew up in, which was a little backwater, blue-collar town of people with modest incomes by and large. You know, it's now become a Silicon Valley rich people's bedroom community and play town. Well, I sort of would love to go back to Chuck Abbott's Pacific Garden Mall before the earthquake when the courthouse in Santa Cruz was still there and the bands played outside when the weather's good, which is, what, 300 days a year in Santa Cruz? But it's gone. And it's just, oh, I wish it was there, but it's not. But there are people who they just can't cope with this. And you're seeing Donald promoting the idea of violence against people who in any way threaten a view of the world that they don't like. There were fine people shouting blood and soil. Fine people. During the campaign. You know, it used to be we would just punch that guy, but we're not allowed to do that anymore. Well, I don't know, as best I can tell, you can still punch somebody, but as then as now, if you're convicted of a crime, you're going to go spend some time at the Gray Bar Hotel. He actually made a remark about killing people like me. In one of his talks, he said, yeah, I really hate the journalists over there, and I wouldn't kill them. I wouldn't kill them. I'm sorry, why would you bring that up? And you would bring it up because you are a power monger. And you are remaking the government of the United States of America to be an instrument to oppress people, not to ennoble the human spirit. Now, I have an enormous amount of sympathy for elected Republicans, because the reality is, unless every single elected Republican stands up, or virtually all of them in Congress, they will be picked off the same way Donald picked off the other 16 candidates in the Republican primaries. Robert Mercer, the hedge fund billionaire, whose company Cambridge Analytics, I suspect that we will find, I can't prove this, but I suspect we'll find at the end of the day that the reason the Russians were able to buy such highly targeted ads on Facebook and Twitter was the data from Cambridge Analytics. Well, Robert Mercer, Steve Bannon's money man, has said that the value of all human beings depends on their net worth, that most Americans have no value at all, and that his cats are more valuable than most Americans because at least his cats, when he strokes them, give him pleasure. This is a man who's had more influence economically, I believe, on what's happening in Republican politics than the Koch brothers. Now, the Koch brothers are not venal. Whatever you think of them, understand that they are serious people. They are actually good managers of their companies. They are competent managers. And on a personal level, they're nice guys. Of course, I've known mob guys, including a hitman, who was pretty much a nice guy, unless you were on the wrong end of some assignment he had. But Mercer is not like that. The Koch brothers believe their stuff. They're not corrupt. They're not venal. They believe what they're doing, and they're serious. Mercer is a totally self-indulgent guy who doesn't believe in democracy. Now, there have been several polls in recent years of millennials, and roughly one in four millennials doesn't believe in democracy. So those of you who are looking at the crowd, I think it's probably mostly grandparents, who are millennials, you know, you should be asking about this. And by the way, I hopefully will be invited back after my new book comes out in January at some point, what book we've titled, It's Worse Than You Think, about the Trump administration. And if you come back, what I would like to see is that people who have gray hair have brought people who don't have any gray hair yet. You know, I'm going to bring a neighbor, the kid who fixes your lawn, or grandchildren, or somebody, or students, but get some young people in the room, okay? So, go back to what Trump is doing here. Donald Trump is systematically undermining the structure of our government. If you take government data and take it down and destroy it because we don't need it anymore, which they've done at some of the agencies, even if there were people there who copied it all and rescued it, it's pretty much lost for law enforcement purposes. We have a database of every single reported pollution incident of any consequence in this country since Richard Nixon signed the pollution laws, the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. To show this company, A, has been an enormous polluter and violator and has thumbed its nose at the law so that you can get real penalties, requires a record. But now, because they've removed these records from the official files, even if a new administration comes in, if you're a big polluter, you're going to say, I'm sorry, Your Honor, you can't rely on this record over here. This record was taken down by the previous administration, and they say they destroyed it. We've got affidavits they destroyed it. And for all we know, this record that's being presented to us was just made up by these EPA zealots. In the case of student loans, Donald Trump, throughout the campaign, he's going to be the champion of students. And so what happened as soon as Betsy DeVos got in? Well, Betsy DeVos became the champion of bankers. And the government officially took the position of the bankers against the students. This is a remake of the government. This isn't draining the swamp. Donald Trump has turned Washington, D.C. into a federally protected wetland for billionaire predators. And he is stalking the swamp with the most predacious and voracious alligators he can find. You'll notice Donald Trump is going around saying, we should be one country, we should be unified. Well, that's what dictators say. That's what they say in China. The founders of this country, and more importantly, the framers of our Constitution, of this, the second American Republic. The first one failed because it had no power to tax, so we gave Congress the power to tax us. The framers of this country explicitly wanted us to have disagreements and public disagreements. They put in the First Amendment not just the right of free speech, the right of religion or non-religious belief, but they put in a right to petition the government for a redress of grievances and to assemble peaceably to protest. We should never be unified about anything except a direct attack on us by a foreign entity, and even then we should be cautious about what we're thinking. We should be a focal point of ideas. You have a better idea, sell it to the public. But what we're seeing is an effort to suppress these ideas. One of the worst things the Trump administration is doing is they are about to allow Sinclair Broadcasting to have television stations in every single market. Now, Sinclair is like Fox. The only two news organizations that I know of in America of any size that tell journalists what they're to say. If you walked into the newsroom of the New York Times, the LA Times, even the Chronicle, and said, here's today's line, and we're going to do it this way, we're going to just walk out. We're not going to do that. That's not what we're here for. You can't tell us what to do. We can't make you put it in the paper, but you can't make us write it the way you want it written. And we're certainly not going to follow a line. But that happens at Fox, and it happens at Sinclair. Sinclair is the company that was behind the swift voting of John Kerry. So here's John Kerry, rich boy who could have easily gotten out of the war in Vietnam, volunteers, along with Bill Rood, the other lieutenant commander, because they had swift boats went in pairs, who, by the way, was my editor at the LA Times for about a year, invented a new military tactic that saved countless American lives in Vietnam. He, in the swift boating, was made out to be a coward and a liar. There's no basis in fact for any of the things the Sinclair people did. And they're the ones who did it, and they're now being rewarded. Why? Because during the campaign, they ran softball pieces everywhere. They ordered them run that were nothing short of propaganda for Donald Trump's election. Now, all of this can only change if one thing happens. It is the only thing at the end of the day that matters in a democracy. People have to go to the polls. Scott Walker is still the governor of Wisconsin because the Democrats in Wisconsin and the unions in Wisconsin thought they could outspend the Koch brothers. I mean, just think about how ludicrous that is. What they should have done, instead of buying ads and paying consultants, was put out the call to people and said, hey, if you're out of a job, we got a job for you for one day. Show up at 6 a.m., we're gonna fill your gas tank, we want you to drive people to the polls all day long, and at the end of the day, we're gonna fill your gas tank back up again and pay you a couple hundred dollars for your time. And if they'd done that, they would have won. Hillary Clinton didn't win Michigan, in part because of a law the Democrats didn't think through and didn't fight tooth and nail and didn't go to court against. In Michigan, poll watchers are supposed to keep a tally of how many people voted. And at the end of the day, when the polls close, if the two tallies don't match, they throw out all the ballots. They don't say, oh, well, now we have to close scrutinize these ballots. They throw them out. Well, what a convenient way to say, hey, just be a little sloppy in your vote count. And you know where almost all the votes that were thrown out in Michigan were from? Detroit and Flint. Wayne County and Saginaw County. Those would have been Clinton votes overwhelmingly. Voter identification laws. Rules on when you can register, on how many days voting is available, how available voting is for people who can't go to the polls on election day. All of these are part of a campaign for permanent minority government. And it will get worse if it doesn't stop in 2018. Now, given Donald Trump's behavior, the Democrats should romp in 2018. They should take control of Congress and have a significant margin in Congress, and if they do that, there will be impeachment proceedings and serious investigations of what the Trump administration is doing in many areas, and we will probably not see that because there's no indication that the Democrats have gotten their act together for the next election. I got an email from Nancy Pelosi, one of these things, saying, please send a dollar. All hope is lost if you don't send $3. Really ridiculous email marketing. I sign up for lots and lots of these things because I want to see them. And it says, the polls show that we're probably going to win 6 seats in 2018. Well, you're still a minority at 6 seats. You got to have a strategy and a plan. And it's going to be hard. In Pennsylvania, where because of voter registration, it should be 2/3 Democrats in Congress and 1/3 Republicans, it's the reverse. Because what the Republicans figured out to do as they paid attention to their knitting over the years is create districts that are 53-54% Republican, and then create districts that are like 80%-70% Democrat. Corral all the Democrats into a district where their votes become meaningless. And now you can win elections. Where were the Democrats? They weren't paying attention to their knitting. They weren't doing the fundamental work. Now, if you live in Berkeley in 2018, there's not much you can do living here in Berkeley to change the outcome of things. I mean, as we all know, Berkeley is a rabid center of right-wing Republican politics. But you can get in the car and drive over to Bakersfield. You can get on the airplane if you've got the resources to do it and fly up to Oregon or Idaho. You can get young people and say, okay, listen, you 6 college students, we'll pay for the car and the hotel room if you'll go to place X and help get people to the polls. That's all that matters at the end of the day, is going to the polls. It's not that difficult. It's not rocket scientist. And even with the interference of the Russians, and there's no question they were collaborating with the Russians, if you want a good indication of that, go to the New York Times website, look up the story that has the emails from Rob Goldstone to Don Trump Jr., and carefully read the very first email. And what you will see is that without saying so, that email makes it clear that this was not out of the blue. You know, some relationship already existed. And it was assumed in that email that Donald Trump knew there was some form of cooperation between the Crown Prosecutor, the Attorney General of Russia, or some other Kremlin official in the Trump campaign. So I don't want to leave you depressed, and I want to have Brian come up here, and we're going to deal with questions. But what I do want to do is say to you, if you want our democracy to endure, this is the moment. Thank you. Almost everybody in this room looks old enough to remember Watergate. For all the crimes Richard Nixon committed, Spiro Agnew, you know, went to prison, Nixon's tax guy went to prison, nobody for 1 minute suspected that Richard Nixon was a disloyal American and an agent of a foreign government. I didn't like a lot of things he did, and I suspect you didn't either. But nobody thought he was doing anything except what, in his view, was the best things to advance his presidency and the interests of the country. Donald Trump, clearly, at an absolute minimum, has divided loyalties between the United States of America and the government and the Kremlin. We have seen Republican leaders in Congress and many individual Republicans who have been interviewed by journalists, many of them on network television, say they trust the Kremlin and Vladimir Putin more than the CIA and the NSA and the FBI. Now, when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, if somebody had said, one day there will be a Republican president who's going to speak admiringly of the leader of the Kremlin, and Republicans are going to denounce American intelligence agencies and support the Kremlin, you know, a bunch of us students probably would have gone to the principal and said, you got a teacher who needs to be locked up in an insane asylum. And yet, here's where we are. Donald Trump is, at a minimum, a man of divided loyalties. He has taken an oath of office that includes the phrase, take care to faithfully execute. And it's very clear that while Donald Trump is executing some things, and thank goodness not as many things as he might because he's lazy and incompetent, he's not taking care and he's not being faithful. He is taking actions, however, that clearly benefit the Russians and further the interests of the Russians. And let me be very clear. Vladimir Putin is a serious threat to democracy. Vladimir Putin's own words are that democracy is a sick joke, that leaders like him should be in charge. He got the Duma to pass a law that allows him to murder Russians just so long as they're not on Russian soil. His leading political opponent was shot to death within sight of the Kremlin. He's poisoned people who were his opponents. He has locked people up. And he, like Donald Trump, operates like the head of a gang. The oligarchs, an international network of major criminals, they're allowed to go out and run their business and do what they want to do until the Godfather calls on them for service. And some of these guys, when they have been recalcitrant or obstreperous in the view of Putin, have found themselves arrested on trumped-up charges, their money taken away, and in a few cases, they've been killed to keep them in line. He has said democracy is a sick joke. He financed Marine Le Pen, the far-right candidate, the virtually Nazi candidate in France, in her campaign for president. He reached out through the Crown Prosecutor to help the Trump campaign. And Don Jr. didn't do the only appropriate thing to do in that circumstance, which is you pick up the phone, you call the FBI and say, I need to speak to someone in counterintelligence. In fact, they told six lies about that email. Six different lies, all of them inconsistent and incompatible. If you want American democracy to endure, if you want the liberties of the people to continue, if you want to continue our journey going from where we were when the Constitution was adopted to where we have gotten, which is a long way, imperfect as we are, if you want a more perfect union, you really got to act, and this is the moment. This is 1933 in Berlin. That's the only reference to those people I'm going to make, but this is the moment. You either get involved now in a smart, strategic way, you get on the phone, you get people to vote, you find a way to support those Republicans who are willing to stand up to Trump, and you find ways to corral Steve Bannon and the dictatorial instincts of the people who are around him, or this is not an anomaly that we will live through and get past. This is the beginning of the slide into fascism. So, thank you. All right, so I'm going to be in the far chair.
So you're going to grab the far seat?
Yeah.
All right, so again, if you want to submit questions, we're taking them on irregularly shaped pieces of paper, and you'll need to flag down Ken.
We're going to do them in writing. Just...
He'll come around. Yeah. Just hold it up. Hold your paper up if you've
he'll
got
come
it.
Get it.
It'll get up to me. So that was fantastic. Thank you. The single most popular question that's come in the stack so far, you were speaking about at the very end of your talk. What do you do about it? How do you get him out?
Yeah. Well, a couple of things to keep in mind about getting Donald out. First of all, Donald's in terrible health. Interestingly, well, not maybe not good. When he was walking with Melania and Macron and Macron's wife, they stopped. And they talked for a long time. And independently, we hadn't talked to each other. Tim O'Brien, Michael D'Antonio, and I, who are Trump's three leading biographers, all appeared the next day on television and said he stopped because he was winded. He rides a golf course when he plays golf. He has no stamina of any kind. When he was going in the campaign saying, Hillary's lazy, Hillary has no stamina, he was talking about himself. He projects. If Donald Trump is removed because of a stroke, a heart attack, or death, Mike Pence becomes president. Now, I don't think Mike Pence is electable. Seriously, I don't think he's electable. If Mike Pence is electable, we just, you know, should just burn the Democratic Party because there's nothing there. They can't beat him. But he would become president, and he is strategic, And I believe the claims, the statements that he has said, you know, we should hang gays and many other comments, because I've talked to people in Indiana who were state government workers who dealt with him. If Trump is removed by impeachment and conviction by the Senate, unless he is convicted criminally and sent to prison, he will spend the rest of his life traveling the country fomenting revolution and violence. And the long-term consequences of that could be disastrous for the country. So if the Democrats are going to move to impeach him if they get control of the House, they need to do it with a plan to make sure he goes to prison. And he's committed many, many crimes in his life. So a number of them I outline in from the public record in the book. The third thing to keep in mind is that in the 2020 election, if he loses by anything less than an absolute landslide, well, Democrats stole the election. And that this will also be bad. I mean, this is, you can't just say, I want him out of there. You got to think about this in long-term strategic ways, not just short-term tactical ways.
You said he's committed multiple crimes. Why haven't they stuck? Why haven't charges stuck?
Because, well, let me back up. The definition of being a successful criminal is you never get arrested. Up until the big mob trials when Rudy Giuliani was the U.S. attorney, and some people believe was basically shutting down the competition, mob bosses didn't go to jail very often. And if they did, it was for relatively short periods of time. I had Harry Kalidoris identified by the FBI as the number two hitman in the western U.S. in my home back in the 80s, bouncing my then seventh child in diapers on his knee while I made his coffee, and he told about whacking people. And one of the things Harry was most proud of was he'd never been arrested. The world's full of criminals who never get arrested, especially white-collar criminals. You know, but that doesn't mean that we can't go back and make cases, because they're there. And by the way, like rape in California, like murder everywhere in the United States, tax fraud has no statute of limitations. And I've shown, and you'll read in the book, that Donald Trump committed tax fraud in 1984, and I'm sure he did it subsequently, and that's another possibility of issues to go after him.
Well, which begs the question, it's public, it's in writing, why isn't it being prosecuted? Is there a failure of prosecutorial will?
Yes. I mean, basically, you know, if you read about what happened with Cyrus Vance, the Manhattan DA, and Donald and Ivanka not being prosecuted over real estate fraud, you know, there were conversations between powerful people and campaign contributions, and they decided there wasn't enough evidence. That's what happened with the Harvey Weinstein case, where they have a tape of him confessing to a crime. It's not going to nail him for flat-out rape, but they've got him on a crime they could nail him for, and they didn't prosecute him. You know, America, it shouldn't be a surprise to people. We have two standards of justice in America. You know, one for poor people, people who were defenseless, and one for smart, well-lawyered people who commit sophisticated crimes with an ink pen.
How seriously do you take the Russia investigation?
I think that Robert Mueller's team, which is an incredible team of prosecutors, if they all decided to open up a law firm after this, they would just blow away every other white-collar defense law firm in the country. He's got the best people. But they are seriously digging into the Russian stuff, and Donald has Russian connections and transactions that make no economic sense that go back decades.
But it seems like there's three separate lines of inquiry that are not necessarily related, and we've got several questions expressing some skepticism, right?
Yep.
One is whether he has sketchy business dealings with Russian interests.
Right.
A separate one is whether actors associated with the Russian government trying to influence the election. And the third is whether there was any collusion with the Trump campaign. Any one of those three things can be true without the other two being
correct.
True.
That's correct. But let's, you know, first of all, there's no question there was collusion. We know that from the emails and Don Jr.'s response. He took the meeting. So we have collusion, that's one. And the argument that, well, you know, my boy, his father referred to his almost 40-year-old son as a boy. I'm sorry, you know, where's the Republican phrase, personal responsibility? we know that the Russians were trying to interfere in our election. We have all the intelligence agencies in agreement. We have other intelligence agencies in foreign governments saying the Russians were doing this. And we know that Donald has had financial dealings with Russians. You know, when Donald says, I have nothing to do with Russia, okay, just put an N on the end of it. And there's an abundant record of that. And I think all of these things are interconnected. They're not clean and simple. But the way someone like Vladimir Putin looks at his intelligence activities is he has a limited budget because he's running a poor country with a one-note economy. So he can't roll tanks out and defeat NATO. But using cyber warfare, he can disrupt, he can steal. The whole Icelandic bank scandal was a Russian oligarch scam to try and figure out a way to steal the wealth of the West. All the money laundering has to do with those things. And they think of it the way the people down here on Page Mill Road in Palo Alto think about it. You got 100 opportunities to put money. 95 of them are going to be worthless. They're going to lose all the money. 4 of them will earn back the money you lost. And then you get one grand slam home run, Amazon. And it makes up for all the rest of it. Well, Donald Trump is Putin's Amazon.
But how much of a nexus is there between having dealings with corrupt oligarchs from Russia and having dealings with the Russian state?
The oligarchs are instruments of the state. They are an international group of criminals who got their money by the government stealing the wealth of the Russian people when the Soviet Empire collapsed. And the oligarchs owe their fortunes and their lives to Vladimir Putin. So this is not a perfect unit. It's more like a mafia gang than a government bureaucracy. But we're talking about a unified entity here.
Switching gears, yeah. There's also a lot of questions about the state of the Democratic Party and whether it's worth putting any energy into. Why do you think the Democratic opposition to Trump has been as meek as you described so far?
I'm not a politics reporter, you know, just as I've always covered Washington from afar, from Los Angeles and Rochester, New York, and when I worked for the New York Times, my immediate editor thought I was going to go to Washington. I said, no, we're not going to do that, or we'll never really cover the IRS. I'm staying in New York City. And he goes, how can you do that? And I said, because I'm going to cover the paperwork. And this is not my field, but the Democrats have to go to the same pool for money under the systems we have. After Watergate, we put in place these campaign finance reform laws that have turned out to be a disaster. They're worse than what we had, I believe, at the time of Nixon. They've concentrated power and secret money spending in narrow hands. The Buckley, Valeo, and Citizens United decisions of the Supreme Court have given political rights and donor rights to corporations. And the Hobby Lobby, by the way, gave corporations religious rights, you know? Dear Mammon, we pray to thee for more profits. The Democrats have a problem in that where are they going to get the support and money? We've decimated unions. The Democrats were the working party of working people. Look how many people who are today say they're Republicans are truck drivers and janitors and people who work in factories, to the extent we still have factory jobs. The Democrats have lost their way, but you don't have any other option here except to rebuild them. And what you need, I think, is Nancy Pelosi is brilliant in terms of how you deal with the inner workings of Congress. She's loved and supported by most of the Democrats who are in Congress. But she's not a great tactical or strategic person for national campaigns. And the Democrats need to start developing people who can do that and listening to them and not listening to people who keep losing elections.
Do you think the fact that Democrats go to the same trough as Republicans accounts for the Clinton campaign's failure to really concentrate fire on Donald Trump's business record?
I don't know. Hillary Clinton, who I, disclosure here, probably have some hidden bias here. She tried to get me fired at the New York Times. You know, Hillary Clinton ran a very strange campaign. I mean, Donald Trump kept implying he's a Christian and she's not. This is a woman who's a practicing Methodist who travels with her Bible and prays with her staff every day. How many of you knew that? Yeah, nobody knows it, because as a good Methodist, she wouldn't talk about it, but her staff wouldn't talk about it. There is a book that will come out November 8th, and I hope you guys give a lot of attention to it, from Donna Brazil, with Danelle Morton, a journalist I trained who lives in Vallejo. And Donna Brazil was the head of the Democratic National Committee. And that book will really tear into the Clinton campaign and the mistakes they made. And Hillary Clinton is somebody who has been beaten up so many times for so many years that she has apparently these scars where she won't listen to people, and she only takes advice from a narrow group of people. I mean, I wrote and said on national TV that Hillary Clinton should take away the speaking issue from the speech fees issue from Donald Trump. Just give the money away. Go give it to the Children's Defense Fund. Give it to a bunch of community foundations. My wife runs a community foundation. But you know, just disgorge the money and take the issue away from him. And by the way, he got bigger fees than she did, and he got them from multi-level marketing firms, you know, what we used to call pyramid schemes. And she didn't do that, you know. When he was following her around on the stage, you know, I'm not of the school that says she should have turned around and said, "What are you doing, you creep?" I think that would have looked bad. But she could have just turned around and walked him back and then said, "That's where you stay until I finish." But, you know, she didn't run a good campaign. Al Gore didn't run a good campaign. I mean, when Democrats keep running not very good campaigns, and Donald, whatever else you think of him, he was fascinating. I mean, we all rubberneck. Everybody in this room, anybody who says, "I don't rubberneck," come on. We all rubberneck when there's an accident on the highway. Donald Trump is a crash on the highway with fireworks, a marching band, and dancing girls.
Speaking of elections, we've had several questions I'm going to condense into run, expressing some amount of skepticism about the ability to accomplish things through the next election. They've focused on three things: the possibility of hacking voting machines, yeah, gerrymandering, making it very hard for Congress to be representative of the popular will, and a third one on the census, with Wilbur Ross running the 2020 right. U.S. Census.
Well, on the gerrymandering one, the districts the Republicans create to do this, because they're the minority party and their long-term outlook is more and more of a minority party, are 53 to 56%, mostly 53 to 54% Republican. That's a pretty good margin. You can get in and beat them by getting people to the polls. That's why it matters. If you've got a Republican district that's 70% Republican, just forget about it, unless the congressman, you know, as the famous saying goes, was caught in bed with a dead boy, or what is the saying, a dead boy or a live girl?
Dead girl, live boy.
That's it. Dead girl, live boy. Thank you. You know, they're going to keep that seat. I'm very concerned about hacking machines. In 1992, computer scientists for social responsibility at Princeton did the first report about how vulnerable vote counting machines were. They hired my wife to write the English language version of the computer scientist's report. And a few of you may recall that on CBS, Dan Rather, who was the anchor man, stood in front of a voting machine and put in a ballot for Jefferson, and it came out that he'd voted for Jefferson, and then when they counted the votes, he'd voted for Adams. And three courts in three states have held that the makers of vote counting equipment have a proprietary right to the confidentiality of their code, known as spaghetti code, that trumps the public's right to audit the election. Now, that is just stunning. We're going to elevate property rights above the most basic parts of democracy. And I would like to see, I don't expect it'll happen, but I would like to see us go to what Canada does: paper ballots with proper controls. And the most basic, simple control on paper ballots is when the ballot box is sealed, and the cops always drive these things in, the Democrat and the Republican, the two poll watchers, go with the deputy or the cop. You record the mileage of the car when it arrives. You record the mileage of it when it leaves. And you get the sheriff or the police chief to say, any officer who we find was involved in tampering with a ballot is fired. No, we're worried about whether we're going to prosecute him for a crime. You're fired. It's not hard to have honest elections. You just have to spend a little money on them and work on them. And the third part was about the census. I'm less worried about the census. The census requires so many people who are career people involved in trying to make the government work. People go to work for the government, go there because they want to try and make the world better in some way. You know, and some of them have quirky personalities and whatnot, but they're not there because they're not going to work. People in government offices work. And Ross will undoubtedly try to do some things to the census, but I'm really not particularly worried about that. If we begin to see memos and things come out to the contrary, I'll change my view because the facts change. But it strikes me as speculative and not likely to be a big issue.
Let me inject a fourth issue, voter rolls. This is going to be tried in the Supreme Court in the Husted case, but
yes.
I think probably an even bigger hacking vulnerability than voting machines.
Yeah. You know, the Republicans learned in the Florida election in 2000 the benefits of just wholesale removing names. So there were people who had their names removed as felons who'd never been arrested in their lives. And they also learned the brilliance of strategically placing machines. In Ohio, students who went to the second most liberal college in America, Oberlin, had to stand in line for like 5 hours to vote. One of my daughters is at Bryn Mawr studying another liberal enclave. She had to wait in line for about 2.5 hours to vote. But if you were in the places Shaker Heights, which are much more conservative in Ohio, you know, you just walked up and voted. And there'll be lots of games played like this, and you're never going to get broad public attention for that, and the Republicans know it. Maybe a much better solution is to go to ballots by mail, which is what they do in Oregon. It's what they're about to do, by the way, in Rohnert Park or Santa Rosa because of the fires.
Switching to the shorter term, what's happening while Donald Trump's in office?
Yeah.
You're our tax expert. What do you read of the politics behind the tax plan that's about to enter discussion in Congress?
This is an unbelievable scam. We see all these people saying this is a middle-class tax cut. 67% of the benefits, two-thirds of the benefits go to the 1%, which is people above $600,000 a year in next year. Donald Trump, if he were worth $10 billion, which he's not, would save $4 billion. By the way, nobody in the news reported that when he finally signed his financial statement as president, he only showed $1.4 billion. Even if you took all the $50 million and ups and doubled them, you don't get to $2 billion. Nobody reported that. I thought, boy, this is a big deal. Anyway, even if he only has $2 billion, he would save $800 million with the repeal of the estate tax. Donald wants to lower the top tax rate on pass-through businesses from 39.6% to 25%. Donald has over 500 such businesses. But I don't benefit from this. They're just lying. I mean, they aren't even making a pretense of anything. They're just lying about it. And Kirsten Gillibrand, the junior senator from New York, who might be the first woman president in this country, Kirsten, said, this is just a scam. And it's astonishing to watch this and to see that the Democrats aren't, jumping up and down about this, because I'll tell you what it will do to us if they pass these big tax cuts. George Bush's tax cuts were premised on the notion that they will make you better off than in the year 2000. That's his statement, not mine. I didn't pick the year. He picked the year. Well, I track the data every year. I do lots and lots of data analysis. From 2001 through 2012, the 12 years that his tax cuts were in effect, Americans' incomes fell. Incomes, not taxes, incomes, by $6.6 trillion. Now, there's a meaningless number. Per household. It's enough money that you could have paid all the income taxes at the average rate, assumed it was all labor income, so you had to pay Social Security and Medicare taxes on all of it, and you'd have enough money left over to pay off every car loan in America, every credit card debt in America, every student loan in America, and you'd each have $20,000 in the bank. That's how much it cost. And this will do the same thing. Anybody here own a business? I mean, I started a business once. I'm now out of it. Did you ever hire somebody because you got a tax cut? You only hire people because you need work done. You don't hire people. What a crazy idea. We're going to hire somebody for a tax cut. You hire people because you have work that needs to be done, and you only have work that needs to be done when people have money to spend buying your products and services. This is just a giveaway to the super rich. It's a reward to the big donor class who backed the Republicans, and the economy will get worse. The growth we've been having since 2013 will fairly quickly slow down.
So I guess that's the political question behind the policy question for me, is does the tax plan single that there's pretty good elite consensus behind the Trump administration. So if you read a lot of the Washington reporting that's rolled out like court gossip,
right,
it's Trump at odds with this branch of the Republican leadership, Trump at odds with that branch of his Republican leadership. Here's who in the donor class is unwilling to open their wallets because he's the figurehead of the party, or it's here's who's about to quit in his cabinet.
Right.
You seem to take his administration much more seriously than that reporting would lead most people to.
Well, look, if you can get a bill passed that'll save you on your $100 million year income, $15 million, you're probably going to speak out in favor of it unless you're Warren Buffett. I mean, this is just craven. This is just appealing to nature. And every corporate executive I've ever interviewed, when I raise tax issues with them, argues that it is their fiduciary duty to the shareholders to pay less taxes. They've all accepted that as a mantra. So there is, I think, agreement among very wealthy people they'd like to pay less taxes. No question about that. They haven't thought through the consequences of paying less taxes.
If they get it passed, are they at that point done with Donald Trump?
Oh, yeah. No, if the tax thing passes, the only other thing that would be out there, and it would be much narrower, is infrastructure. The number of companies that will benefit from the infrastructure program we need, I mean, I don't think there's any question we need one, that's not the whole economy. It's engineering firms and concrete firms and steel makers, but it's not most companies out there. It's not nearly as broad. So yes, that's a very good point. I think that you would see a lot of people feeling much freer once they got a tax cut to separate themselves from Trump in various ways. Yeah.
What does that look like? Is impeachment a real possibility without Congress changing control?
Impeachment is a possibility with only two things. The Democrats get control of the House, and I don't think they'll actually impeach him unless they know they've got enough votes in the Senate because they've got such a solid case that he'll be convicted.
Which is two-thirds.
Yes.
The threshold
and I don't
for
think
impeachment
they want,
in the
I don't think we want to go through another episode like we had with Bill Clinton over what was a stupid issue, but where they didn't convict him. And secondly, if Donald does something that shocks the conscience of half his donors, if Donald's support falls below 20%, then I'd say he's vulnerable even with the Republicans to support. That the Republicans will only move against him if he does something that makes them feel threatened. I'm a congressman. If I don't move against Trump, I will not get reelected. That's the only option. And he'd have to do something really crazy.
Because you are a tax policy expert, we have at least two questions asking you to psychologically diagnose the president.
Well,
one audience member asks if he's a sociopath.
I mean, look, I'm someone I know who's a psychiatrist is sitting in the audience. I can't wait for the conversation we have later about how I did here. But first of all, Donald is a narcissist. But in the ancient Greek myth, Narcissus comes to a terrible end. So far, Donald's narcissism has gotten him to the most powerful job in the world. He hasn't come to this terrible end. Donald has no empathy for other people. He doesn't have any empathy for anybody. If push comes to shove about his family, I predict that he will look out for himself, not for his family. He'll fight and struggle and do various things, but if he gets to a rock in a hard place, Donald's about Donald. Certainly, Melania, he'd cast her aside in a minute. The tough one he's going to have is Ivanka. And if you haven't done so, just go to the internet, put in images, and type Trump Ivanka parrot. And look very, very carefully at the pictures that you're going to see. And ask yourself if you're a woman, if that were my husband and our teenage daughter, what you would do. You want to see not just the parrot, but the other picture you'll see in the sports car.
What's the third word you're saying?
Trump, parrot, Ivanka. Parrot, like the bird.
The bird. Ivanka, parrot. Like the daughter.
And anyway, so Donald's a narcissist. He has no empathy. He is totally about himself. He's also at times literally delusional. He just makes things up. And he has escape mechanisms for this. He'll say, well, somebody told me that. Or I read that on the internet. He just makes things up. And Donald has done this his whole life. He just fills in the blanks by making things up. Now, all politicians lie. I mean, and sometimes presidents have to lie. Sometimes a president has to lie. It's in the national interest to lie to us. And we can recognize that as opposed to gratuitous lies. Donald lies gratuitously. He lies when the truth would help him. It's just astonishing to watch. He is mentally unbalanced. He is unfit. He is manifestly unfit to serve in any public role of any kind. But the idea that this deranged individual who can be baited by the dictator in North Korea, who can be baited by just about anybody, has his finger on the button is terrifying, and it should be terrifying.
So are those the personality traits it takes to be successful in business in America?
No. No, and in fact, one of the great things about business in America, one of the reasons we're really wealthy, is something Donald totally violates. Trust is the core of successful growth in an economy. You make a deposit on a house, and you trust that that deal will go through and they won't steal your money and run off with it. You have documents and paperwork to support, this is my house, or I paid off my mortgage, or I own these security certificates, or this is my spouse, and we're entitled to these benefits. Donald runs on distrust, lying, and deception. There'll be a story in my new book about somebody who went to extraordinary measures to make sure Donald couldn't cheat him, and he got cheated. And at the end of the day, he won, but it's an extraordinary story of how totally dishonest Donald Trump is.
But one of the through lines in your book from last year, it's out in the lobby, is how financial institutions repeatedly backed him, even when he'd accumulated quite a track record.
Right.
Of burning them. He buys Mar-a-Lago for $5 million, all of which is borrowed from a bank as a personal non-collateralized loan.
Well, no, it's a mortgage they didn't record.
An unrecorded mortgage, excuse me.
And that's illegal for a bank. You are required to record a mortgage, and I have the letter, I quote it in the book, that we're not going to record the mortgage at your request. Yeah, why did they do all this?
Yes.
Well, why do people commit white-collar crimes? I mean, the most common reason they do it is bakshish. You know, somebody got a deal, they got their palm grease, they got a job, you know, they had a hooker sent to their hotel room. I mean, it depends on what your proclivities are. But usually when I've dug into these things as a journalist or have reported on them when law enforcement's doing them, somewhere along the line people get compromised. And, you know, I know you're all shocked that there are corrupt bankers.
There's
a lot in the book about our pile.
You gave a kind of diagnosis of our political moment for why people might be disposed to vote for someone like Donald Trump in the election. What's been interesting to watch since then is the fairly firm floor his polling numbers have had. Somewhere in the low 30s of the U.S. population.
But that's half of the Republicans.
And enough of the Republicans to have people in the party still threatened about him backing primary challengers against them. So the question coming from this audience member is why? Why are people staying lined up behind him now that he has a track record in office?
First of all, for most people, it is very, very hard to say I was wrong or I didn't believe something, and it's often a crisis for them. I'm in a field where you have to go where the facts are, and you learn to do that or you get out of the field. So there are things I've believed and thought, and then I've, after reporting, gone, oh my God, what an idiot I was. That's completely wrong. And then you go to where the facts are. But most people don't do that. You know, I mean, just look at the number of people who had all the reason in the world to know about Catholic priests and boys, choir, altar boys, and yet kept sending their kids to be altar boys. Denial is an incredibly powerful institution. And here's a man who has persuaded many people, I am your savior. I alone can save you. And now you want to attack him? My goodness, it's just, the disconnect mentally is enormous. Did I mention the email I got from the woman in Indiana? My favorite email I've gotten, I get some that are hate mail, but actually not very many, but my favorite was earlier this year from a woman in Indiana that said, you know, Mr. Johnston, I don't understand why you keep attacking our president. We finally have a fine Christian family man of integrity in the White House. Well, we all laugh, but if you were reading the news sources she reads, you would believe that. You would believe that Nancy Pelosi is working every day to bring Sharia law to America, and the journalists all hate the country.
Have you ever been threatened for your reporting?
Oh, lots of times.
What's that look like?
Well, I've come home bruised up a few times when I was young. It's just, you know, firefighters run towards fires, police officers run towards gunfire, I run towards stories, and I can't not do it. I was once told by a very senior LAPD officer when I was exposing the LAPD, he went and met me in an out-of-the-way place, he said, I'm concerned that you're going to get killed, not directly by the LAPD, but somebody who's doing work for him, and he laid out to me exactly how he would do it. And it was very smart. They would never be able to catch anybody for doing it. And I said to him, well, I have to do what I have to do. I can't not do it. It's who I am. On the other hand, I immediately went home, got out my typewriter, and wrote a 30-page memo in case I was dead wrong and planted it in six places. So, but, you know, you have to do what you have to do. I mean, I'm somebody who's literally run into a burning building. I've hunted down personally and confronted a vicious murderer alone. It's just, you know, I probably have a screw loose.
Has Donald Trump ever threatened you?
Oh, sure. Donald's been threatening to sue me since 1989. The last time we spoke was April of last year when he called me at home to tell me he was going to sue me if he didn't like the way I wrote it. And, you know, I've never in my whole career ever had a politician come within a million miles of saying, you have to write it the way I want or I'll sue you. But that's how Donald thinks. I mean, he said, I want laws passed. Journalists shouldn't be allowed to write things that I don't approve of.
But that's one thing to deal with when you've got the backing of the, liability insurance and legal department of the New York Times behind you.
Yeah, but I was on my own. I've been retired from the New York Times for 9 years.
That's my point.
Yeah.
How do you take those threats when you're on your own?
Donald wants to sue me, he can sue me. I mean, it's just, you know, when I did an expose of how General Electric engaged in 30 years of tax fraud for tax analysts, a nonprofit, non-advertising publication with about $22 million a year revenue, they flew two jet loads of lawyers down to this outfit's offices in Great Falls, Virginia. And I wasn't in the room, but I was told by the people who were there that one of the top GE lawyers said, you know, you're going to denounce this Johnston and you're going to retract everything he said. And he said, you have to show us what's wrong with it. Well, it's all wrong. Well, it can't all be wrong. Just any errors, we will correct them without question. And he finally said, you know, you don't seem to understand. We could sue you out of existence. You're a tiny organization. And David Bernori, bless his soul, said, I am told, well, if you think you have a case, you should bring it. The only thing, the way you deal with bullies, you have to stand up to them. There's one question I promised I would mention to somebody. Somebody in the audience asked me something ahead of time, and I said if the question didn't come up, I would bring it up because it's an important issue. Part of the reason Trump has gotten where he has is because of this enormous change in income inequality. The founders of this country wrote about income inequality a lot. I did a Newsweek story called Why Thomas Jefferson Favored Profit Sharing. And they believed that if something would ultimately destroy this country, it was going to be extreme economic inequality. That there would arise, this is my word, a business aristocracy that would persuade people who had neither tools nor land to vote for policies that they were tricked into believing were good for them, when in fact those policies were bad for them and good for the oligarchs. Sort of like what I think has been going on in this country. And to get us an idea of the scope of this inequality, from 1961 to 2013, the average income of the bottom 90% of households in America after tax went up. that every dollar you had in 61, you had $1.25 in 2013. 52 years later, and your income had gone up a half a penny a year. Imagine that now as the amount of money that went up by $5,000, $5,500. And imagine we put $5,500 in the shoebox, and we stood the shoebox on end here on my knee. It's a foot high, right? Most shoeboxes put them on end about a foot. How did the top 400 tax return people do? They aren't the people with the biggest incomes in America. They're just the biggest incomes that Congress said you have to report on your tax return. They'd have more boxes, right? I mean, they'd have more boxes with $5,500 in them. In fact, their boxes would reach up to the ceiling, through the ceiling of this building, 7 miles, 35,200 boxes to one box. And by the way, their tax rates fell by 46%, and these people's tax rates went up 1%. Now, this is going to get worse because the economy is changing. All these good-paying industrial jobs that were crucial to Donald Trump's election going away, those jobs are created by inefficiency. When steel was first made in India 2,000 years ago, more than 2,000 years ago, big guys with big muscles would pound charcoal into iron to create steel. It took multiple years of labor to produce 1 ton of steel. In the ancient world, sometimes vanquished countries were told that you had to pay your tribute so we didn't kill all of you, not in gold or silver, but in steel. If you watch Game of Thrones, notice how much of it is about Valyrian steel. Inefficiency creates jobs. Today, it takes 40 minutes of labor to create a ton of steel. Not years, 40 minutes. Those jobs are never coming back. And lots of other jobs are going to go away. The internet has been destroying all sorts of things. It's destroying the news business. It is the only business it isn't destroying, by the way, is real estate, because real estate's based entirely on race. You know, what neighborhood are you going to live in? What schools? It's an entirely race-based industry. And as technology advances and capital does more and more labor, as machines do more and more work, not just robots, but machines, we're going to face a real crisis about this. And so one of the things we need to be discussing is either universal capitalism, where everybody owns capital and you get income from the capital, or universal incomes. The experiments that have been done with universal incomes turn out to not produce the result most people would expect. Most people would say, well, if you give everybody $1,000 a month, a whole bunch of people will just sit home and drink beer and smoke dope. And they've done this experiment in India. They've done it in some other places around the world. And it turns out, what do people do? They work hard. They go, oh, I got this base now. And now I can like invest in buying a donkey to haul stuff. Or I can start a business. Or I can send my children to get an education so one of them can become a doctor. And in India, there's a law in some provinces where the government must hire you 100 days a year. People work about a little over 200 days a year, so it's half pay. And what's the effect of that been? It drives up wages in the private sector, and everybody's better off. And so universal basic income or universal capitalism, which was promoted heavily by a San Franciscan named Louis Kelso, who wrote the Capitalist Manifesto 60 years ago, are issues that we need to really pay attention to as we go forward. And if we don't, well, Karl Polanyi said the reason we got World War II was that people in Europe lost control of their economic lives and didn't know what to do, and they looked around for an answer, and they found Mussolini and Hitler. People want control of their economic lives, and we have to have policies to do that. And the world we live in is a different world than we grow up in. We started out as an agrarian country. We became an industrial country. We're now a digital country. Very soon, we're going to be a biological country. And the world's going to be different in many, many ways, and we have to adapt to that. We can't go back to 1950 the way Donald Trump thinks we should.
Is it a critique that's come out of the left recently of the push for universal basic income? John Nichols and Robert McChesney, in the last book they co-authored, made it, which is that a lot of the push in America for universal basic income is coming from tech and libertarian quarters that see it going hand in hand with dismantling the welfare state, eliminating public goods, and making people spend their allowance on things that they currently get for free, like schools and libraries and so forth.
Yeah, every good idea can be perverted. yes, one of some of the proposals for universal basic income would make people worse off. In my next book, you'll read about how Trump is trying to do something to veterans that would make them much worse off, even though he claims to be their champion. I think the basic idea of universal income is that everybody gets a base, including Bill Gates, $1,000 a month, for example, and that we get rid of this tax system with all these funny rules. The book I have put off writing and will go back to writing very, very shortly is A Whole New Tax System for America. And so I have to address these issues. And one of them is we give people on average $100 a month per child in tax benefits. Well, let's just take it out of the tax system and write you a check every month for $100. What if people get divorced? We can deal with that. Those are minor problems to deal with. But this idea that we give you a basic income and then, well, if you worked and paid into Social Security and had more coming, that we take that away? No, no, no. This is a new base. If you want to get rid of Social Security, you got to phase it out over the lifetimes of people so the people who aren't born yet don't get it or aren't going to work yet don't get it, but everybody else gets it. And the object is to provide people with a base so that there's money flowing through the economy. It provides stability in the economy, and it encourages people to work. And to the extent that you find that there are people who don't want to work, then you have to deal with those pathologies. You know, we'll always have people. I mean, people make different choices. And there is no one worker. There's no one shareholder, you know. And there's no one solution to things. But we need to address driving around today. I was going to go see the Museum of Capitalism. It's closed already. But driving through the neighborhood in Oakland down by the waterfront near Jack London Square, I was just appalled to see the poverty, the people who were living in put-together makeup shelters of grocery carts and plastic bags. I mean, come on. Does anybody remember seeing that in the 60s? In the 50s? In the 70s? This is all creation since 1980. And it's, you know, we elected these guys. Even if you didn't vote for them, we as a people elected these folks, and they put in these bad policies that are making life miserable. Well, we can change them. Just elect different people. So,
David K. Johnston, thank you so much.
Thank you.